Okay, then. She takes off like a shot. I jog after her. The ground is more open here, and I can easily track her as she runs. I don't see anything ahead, but she very clearly does, tearing along, veering to the left, me jogging behind, my footfalls punctuating the burble and crash of water over rapids. Water. River. To the left. That's what Storm is running to. Not Dalton, but the one thing she can resist even less than fleeing prey. The siren's call of water. I shout, calling her back, but she keeps running. I don't know if she literally can't hear me, being too far away, or if she figuratively can't hear. The call of that water too great. Damn it, we need to work on this. Buy a whistle and train her to come to it. We also need to seriously consider that pool. It might help her with her water fixation. I can't blame Storm. New Finlands are water dogs. She'll even try getting into the shower with us if we don't close the door. I'm chasing her at full speed, but I'm not worried. We'll be delayed for a few minutes while she splashes and plays. Then I'll continue on with a very wet but happy dog. I hear the crash of the water over rocks, and I realize I know where I am. We came this way a couple of months ago with Anders, just as the spring thaw was setting in. He saw this river rock-filled and fast-running and said it'd be perfect for whitewater kayaking. Dalton said sure, if he could. My steps falter as I remember the rest. Standing on the edge of rock and looking down at the river, as Dalton said,
"Yeah, if we can airlift you down there."
Down into the canyon river, 50 feet below. Chapter 32. "Storm!" I shout. "Stop!" She doesn't slow. I yell louder. She keeps going. I need a whistle. I need a leash. I need to do more goddamn training with her. All of which is a fine idea and perfectly useless at this moment. We reach the rocks and she's leaping over them, heading for that gorge. "Storm! Stop!" I shout it at the top of my lungs. Less than a meter from the edge, she stops. Then she looks back at me and begins edging forward like a child testing the boundaries.
"No!"
Another step. A look back at me. "But Mom, I really want to go this way."
"No!"
I'm moving at a jog now across rocks slick with moss. Storm has taken one more careful step toward the edge. Her nose is working like mad, picking up the scent of the water below.
"No."
"Please, no. Please." She whines. Then she takes another step, and she's almost to the edge.
"Storm, no."
"God damn you, no. Damn you, and damn me for the idiot who didn't bring a lead." She stopped mere inches from the edge. As she whines, I hunker down and say,
"Come."
Whine.
"Come now."
She looks toward the edge.
"Storm, come."
I hear a noise. At first, I think it's the water below. It must be. It cannot be what it sounds like. Storm is growling. At me. She growls again, jowls quivering. My dog is growling at me. I know it can happen. I've read enough manuals to understand that a growl is communication and not necessarily threat. What it communicates is a clear no, a test of dominance. Yet it feels like a threat, like I have failed and she's questioning my authority, telling me she's not a little puppy anymore.
"Storm,"
I say as firmly as I can. Don't show fear, don't show hurt. She lowers herself to the rock in submission, as if I misheard the growl.
"Storm, come here."
Still lying down, she begins belly crawling toward the edge.
"God damn it!"
I don't mean to curse, but my words ring through the canyon. She whines. Then she continues slinking toward the edge. My heart thumps. There are only a couple of feet between us, and I want to lunge and grab her by the collar and haul her back from the edge. Yet if she resists at all, we'll go over. I keep moving, as slowly as I can, trying to figure out how to get her back without turning this into a deadly tug of war. Please, Storm, please come back. Just a little. I can grab you if you come a few inches my way. She puts her muzzle over the edge, and I have to clamp my mouth shut to keep from screaming at her, from startling her into falling. She lies there, looking down. Then she glances back at me. From me to the river below. Her nose works. She whines. I know it's water, I say as I get down onto all fours. I know it looks wonderful. If we keep going down the ridge, there's a basin. You can swim there, I promise. I'm talking to myself. I know that. But I hope my voice calms her, even casts some kind of spell luring her from that edge. Again, though, she looks from me to the river, sniffs, whines. I form a plan. It's dangerous, but there's no way I'm taking a chance she'll go over the edge. I creep along on all fours. When I reach Storm, I rub her flank. My hand travels up her side, still petting, aiming for her collar. I carefully hook my fingers around it. I won't pull Storm until I'm farther from the edge, with a better footing. Before I inch backward, I glance down into the gorge. I'm getting a look at what we face, so I will be prepared should we go over. And the moment I look down, I know I do not want to go over. Glacial ice coming off the mountain has been wearing away rock for centuries, and the walls go straight down. Below, there isn't even a safe amount of water to drop into. It's a shallow mountain river, more of a stream, filled with rapids and... There is something in the water. An unnatural shape, unnaturally colored. Long and slender, black on the bottom, purple and yellow on top. It's the purple and yellow that I focus on. It's a pattern of some sort, and it jogs a memory of me thinking, I haven't seen that shirt before. It's pretty, far more colorful than usual. Did she bring it with her, tuck it at the back of her closet, an unwanted reminder of a time when she hoped for a brighter future in Rockton? This is Val's shirt. It is the blouse I last saw her wearing. I tell myself she's lost it. That maybe she removed it to wash in the stream and it floated away and that's all this is. All this is. That's a lie. An obvious, blatant, ridiculous lie. I see that blouse trapped on the rocks. I see the black below it. The dress trousers she always wore. I see one shoe. One bare foot. Pale against the dark water. I see her arms. Her hands. Equally pale. I see the brown and gray of her short hair. I am looking at Val, at her body, battered against the rocks below. Storm whines. I glance over and she has her muzzle on the edge, her dark eyes fixed on Val. That is why we're here. Not because she smelled water and wanted to go for a swim. She has located her target. We set her on a scent and she has tracked it to its source. I reach to pet her and whisper, I'm sorry. She nudges me and then looks at Val again. Well, there she is, Mom. Go get her. I can't, of course. Not from here. I'm not even sure I can get to her from below. It's a narrow gorge and she's trapped on the rocks. Sure, Val. Go ahead and play spy. It's okay, Val. Just go with Oliver. You'll be fine. We'll get you back. My fault. My responsibility. There is no surge of grief. No tears. I move slowly, looking around for a way to get down, my body numb, the crash of the rapids muted. Storm's muzzle against my hand feels as if she's nudging me through a thick glove. I nod and I murmur something to her. I'm not even sure what it is. All I know is that I need to get Val out of the water for a proper burial. Like Brent. How would you like to be buried, Val? Before you go, just answer me that. In case I fuck up and get you killed, how should you be laid to rest? Any final words you'd like said? Tears do prickle then, but they feel like self-pity and I swipe them away with the back of my hand. I will get her out of the water. I see jutting rock down there with sparse vegetation, a bit of wind-blown soil, and a place for me to lay her body safely out of the water. We'll come for her later. Just get her out before the current dislodges her body and whisks it away. I survey the cliff. It's impossible to climb down right here. It really is an edge with a straight drop below. But if I travel farther down, I see a route with a bit of a slope. I head to it. Storm follows. I reach the spot and tell her to lie down, and then, firmly, to stay. She does, head on her paws. I crouch at the edge. From here, the route looks steeper than it did farther up. But I can do this. Just a bit of rock climbing. I see the first stone to put my feet on. It's a half meter down. Easy. Just back up to the edge and lower my feet over. I do that. I'm holding onto a sturdy sapling with one hand, the other grabbing the rock edge. The rock should be right. It's not right there. I'm past my waist and I don't feel anything underfoot. I glance down. I'm about 6 inches short, that rock farther than it seemed. I take a deep breath and lower myself until my foot touches down and keeps going. I grab my handholds as tight as I can and find my footing before I carefully look. I see my boot and the rock beneath it, a sloping rock. Okay, that's not what I expected, but no. I hear Dalton's voice in my head. Hell and fuck no, Butler. Get your ass back up here now. I look over my shoulder and see Val's body. You feel guilty? Fine. You're going to risk your own life to get her out of there? Not fine. Stupid. Unbelievably stupid, and you know it. You aren't saving her. She's dead. She doesn't give a damn if you bury her body or not. Get your ass up here. Come find me, and we'll see if there's a way to do this safely. He's right, of course. This is unbelievably stupid. The second time I met Dalton, he called me a train wreck, hell-bent on my own destruction. I corrected him. That implied I was a runaway train, not a wreck. I didn't argue with the principal, though. After killing Blaine, I never contemplated suicide. I never tried to die. I just didn't try to live, either. Didn't try to stay alive or enjoy that life while I had it. I felt as if I'd surrendered my future when I stole Blaine's from him. Now, seeing Val's body below, I feel as if I have pulled that trigger again. If anything, this is worse, because I didn't act out of hate and rage and pain. It was negligence, carelessness. But when I think that, I hear Dalton's voice again, telling me not to be stupid. Yeah, he understands the impulse. Fuck yes, he understands it. But we aren't shepherds with our herd of not terribly bright sheep. Mistakes were made. Mistakes will always be made. But I didn't throw Val to this wolf. I tried everything I could to keep Brady from taking her into that forest. I still accept responsibility for Val's death. Yet I have to take responsibility for my life, too. For not doing something stupid because I feel guilty. That leaves Rockton without a detective, and Dalton without a partner. I have made compacts here, implicit ones, with the town, with Dalton, even with Storm. And those say that I won't do something monumentally risky and stupid, or I will hurt them, and they do not deserve that. I dig my fingers into the soil, and I test the sapling I'm holding. It's sturdy enough. I brace and then pull myself. My hand slides on the sapling. It's only a small slip, but my other hand digs in for traction and doesn't find it, and I'm not sure what happens next. It's so fast. Maybe when the one hand loses traction, the other loosens just enough to slide off the sapling. All I know is that I slip. I really slip. Both hands hitting the ravine side with a thump. Fingers digging in, dirt flying up, hands sliding, feet scrabbling for that rock just below. One foot finds it, the other does not, and the one that does slides off, and I fall. I fall. Except it's not a clean drop. It's a scrabble. Hands and feet feeling dirt and rock and grabbing wildly. My brain trapped between, I'm falling, and, no, you're just sliding. Relax. The latter is false hope, though. It's that part of my brain that feels earth under my hands and says I must be fine. I'm not fine. I'm falling, sliding too fast to do more than notice rock under my hands, and then it's gone. And I try to stay calm, to say yes, just slide down to the bottom, just keep. I hit a rock, a huge one. My hands manage to grab something, and my feet try, but they're dangling, nothing beneath them, kicking wildly. And why can't I feel anything beneath them? I've stopped. Both hands clutch rock, a shelf with just enough accumulated dirt for my fingers to dig in and find purchase. There. I'm fine. No, you're not. Where are your legs? I'm fine. Look down. I don't want to. I know what's happened, and I've decided to pretend I don't. See? I stopped falling. No problem. I've totally got this. I look down, and I see exactly what I feared. I am holding on to a ledge, dangling from a rock 30 feet over the water. No, over a thin stream and more rock. The wind is howling, and I think, that's just what I need. But the air is still, and I realize I'm hearing storm. Newfoundlands have an odd howl, one that makes them sound like a cross between a dinosaur and Chewbacca. It's a mournful, haunting sound that has scared the crap out of every Rockton resident. It's been known to wake me with a start when she begins howling with the wolves. I'm okay, I call up to her. Storm, I'm fine. Even if she understood me, she'd call bullshit, and rightly so. I am not fine. I'm dangling by my fingertips over a rocky gorge. I flex my arms as if I might be able to vault back onto that ledge. My fingertips slide, and my heart stops, and I freeze, completely freeze. My left hand finds a rocky knob on the ledge. I grip that and dig in the fingers of my right hand until they touch rock below the dirt. Then I breathe. Just breathe. I glance over my shoulder. Even that movement is enough for my brain to scream for me to stop. Don't take the chance. Stay still. But I do look, as much as I can without loosening my grip. It's a drop. There is no denying that. No chance I could just slide down. I will fall. At best, I will break both legs, and even as I think that, I know that is extreme optimism. Death or paralysis are the real options here. I'm going to die. If I don't die, if I'm only paralyzed, I won't be able to stay in Rockton. And when I think that, it feels the same as death. I want to tell myself I'm being overdramatic, but I know I'm not. Leaving this place would be death for me. Returning to that state of suspended animation, I don't think I could ever return to that. I've had better. So much better. If I can't stay here, I squeeze my eyes shut. Breathe. Just breathe. My arms are starting to ache. One tricep quivers. I strained it last week in the weight room with Anders, twisting mid-extension as he made a joke. Now it's quivering when it should be fine. It is fine. It will be fine. Breathe. I don't breathe. I can't. That quivering tricep becomes a voice, whispering that even holding on is foolish. I can't hold on forever, and there's no other way to go but down. The triceps is quaking now, and my right hand slips. I grip tighter. The rock edge digs into my forearms. Blood drips down my arm. I look left and then right. Maybe that's the way to go. Perpendicular. Get to a safer spot and then slide. I can see one possibility, maybe 10 feet to my left. Between here and there, though, the rock is smooth, and I'm not sure I could find hand grips. Well, you're going to have to try, aren't you? My left hand has a good hold on this rocky nub. I release my right a little and begin inching it left. It's slow going. Millimeter by millimeter, it seems, excruciatingly slow as my dog howls above. I'm almost there. Get my right hand wrapped around that nub, and then my right hits rock. Solid, slick rock. My fingers slide. I try to dig in, but there's nothing to grasp, and my nails scrape rock, and there's a jolt, excruciating pain shooting through my left arm, and... Chapter 33. I'm dangling by one arm. My left hand still clutches that jutting rock, but that's the only thing keeping me on the rock face. And the pain? Holy shit, the pain. I grit my teeth and focus on the fact that I'm still holding on. Not how barely I'm holding, or how much that jolt hurt. I'm still okay. Well, relatively speaking. I make a noise at that. It's supposed to be a chuckle, but it sounds like a whimper. Still hanging on. Still alive. I need to find purchase. Whether it's my right hand or right foot or left foot, just find purchase somewhere. Being slightly lower means I have fresh places to check. Optimism. Awesome. I start with my right hand. Reach up and... All I can do from this angle is scratch the edge of that rock ledge, and my nails are already torn. I reach down instead. There's a rock there, a nub that I can at least grip to brace myself and take some of the pressure off my left arm. I do that, and then I try with my legs, but of course, that would be too much to hope for. I'm still hanging off a ledge, my dangling legs nowhere near the cliffside. I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. Two fingers on my right hand twitch. I'm holding them in an awkward position, trying to keep some semblance of a grip, and they have had enough. Two fingers twitch, then a third joins in. No, no. My right hand slips. That jolt again. My left shoulder screaming as my right hand clamps tighter and... Casey? Casey! I am hearing that, right? Not hallucinating? Fresh pain stabs through my arm. Casey! The voice comes from right above me, and I peer up to see Dalton on his hands and knees, looking over the side, his face stark white. He pulls back, and I want to scream, No! Don't leave me! I remember my nightmares after finding Nicole in the cave. Nightmares where I'm in the hole and everyone leaves me, and Dalton stays the longest, but eventually he, too, gives up on me. I'm hallucinating. He's not really here. It's the pain and the shock and the memory finding a fresh variation to torture me with. Even storm has gone silent above. Pebbles fall, pelting my face.
Are you crazy, boy? A voice bellows. Get your ass back!
The words trail off and I see a foot over the edge. A boot. Dalton's boot. Vanishing as Cypher hauls him up.
You wanna knock her down into that gorge?
Dalton reappears, looking over the edge.
Casey, can you hear me?
Of course she can,
Cypher says.
The whole damn mountain can. Now stop panicking and get back from that edge. Your girl is fine.
Dalton snarls something at him. Cypher's bearded face appears over the edge.
Hey, kitten, he says. How you doing?
He gets a string of obscenities from Dalton for that, but I say, I've been better, and Cypher laughs.
Okay, he says. I'm gonna ask you to try something for me. Take your right hand and bring it up on the other side of your left. You need to reach maybe 4 inches to the left of it.
I do that, and I find a crevice in the rock, one I can dig my fingers into. It's an even better grip than I have with my left, and I ease a little of my weight that way.
And don't get too comfortable, kitten. I'm going to make you switch hands, which will be tricky, but a whole lot easier to maintain. Okay?
Okay. He guides me through it, and a few minutes later, I'm still hanging, but in a far more secure position.
I'm going down,
Dalton begins.
No, Eric, you aren't,
Cypher says.
I'm not rescuing both of you today. How about you help me figure out how Casey can rescue herself?
I'd rather
I know you would. But if you try, I'll throw you down there with that poor drowned woman and save the trouble of having to rescue you.
As he says, poor drowned woman, I turn to see Val's body directly below. Her one arm is stretched over her head, the current catching it in a macabre wave.
Yeah, she's still there, Cipher says. Still dead. Like she was when you apparently decided you had to go after her.
I wanted to retrieve her body.
Why? She doesn't give a damn.
He shakes his head, grizzled hair hanging.
You almost kill yourself for a dead woman. Your boy here tries to turn this into a double suicide mission. And people say I'm crazy. Casey, Dalton calls. Don't move just yet, but I'm going to have you keep shifting left. Once you get past that overhang, you'll be able to get footholds.
Oh, Cipher says.
You're back with us, are you?
Have to, or you'll talk Casey to death.
Dalton leans out.
You're gonna be fine, but if at any point you feel yourself slipping, or if a hold doesn't seem as safe, I want you to stop. No heroics. I can get down there. Got it?
Yes, sir. Dalton guides me. Whenever he hesitates, Cipher points out possibilities, and they debate them quickly, before coming to a consensus. I move about 5 feet left, and then I'm clinging to the cliffside, hands and feet secure. Up or down? I ask.
You can make it up, Cipher says. I'd rather you went down,
Dalton says.
Please.
When I pause, he says,
it's a crawl with no serious obstacles. It's safer.
I start down. Once I'm securely heading that way, Dalton heads along the cliffside to find a more gradual decline. He'll join me, and we'll see if we can get back to Val. Cipher grumbles about that, but we outvote him. I make it down. It's not an easy trip, nor painless or even remotely graceful, as I slide down the last 10 feet on my ass, try to put on the brakes, and land in the icy stream.
It's not a water slide, kitten,
Cipher booms down the gorge. I wave at him as I get to my feet. Dalton is already down, picking his way along the stream. I wave to him, too, as I start toward Val. She's still bobbing, her shirt hooked on a rock. I can't get very close. She's on the other side, and the stream is a good 10 feet across and moving fast with spring runoff. One wrong foot placement, and I'll hurtle downstream.
Wait,
Dalton calls. I am. I sit on a rock. He's discarded his sling, not surprisingly. He's almost there when his foot slips, and I leap up, my hand swinging out. He grabs it, but only gives it a squeeze and says,
You okay?
I am. He nods, and I feel his assessing gaze, stopping on every gash and rising bruise, his lips tightening. I hug him, throw my arms around his neck and squeeze, and that's meant to reassure him. But as soon as I feel him against me, my knees wobble and every muscle unclenches, and if he didn't hug me back tight, I'd have been on the ground.
You're okay?
He says again as he releases me. I'm fine, Eric. But Val...
Yeah, I know. Bastard.
He looks over at Val's body.
I don't see the point, Casey. I really don't.
With people like Oliver Brady, I don't think there needs to be a point. He killed her because he could. He nods as if he understands, but I know he doesn't. He can't. Let's just take her, I'm about to say home. Rockton is our home. It wasn't hers. I'm not sure it ever could have been. Is there some other place to... I'm being foolish when I need to be practical, so I don't finish voicing the thought.
We'll figure something out.
He looks over at her.
All right. Trick will be getting her free without losing her. I'm gonna grab her leg closest to this side.
He starts untying his boots.
It looks about a foot deep. I'll wade. Safer than rock jumping.
There's a clear path just above that rock. Stick to it, or even in water that shallow, you can get your foot caught, and the current will take you down.
I know. If it feels too strong, I'll drop.
He means that he'll fall on his ass and crawl. That's the way to do it. 12 inches of water does seem like a simple wade, but between the current and the slippery rocks below, it's treacherous. He takes it slow, placing one foot down and making sure it's secure before lifting the other. Twice, he just stops and waits until he has his balance. Seeing Val's body this close up leaves little doubt she's been dead and in the water since not long after she disappeared. Her thin face has bloated, and her slender body strains against her clothing. That amount of water retention suggests he killed her on the first day. I can't see how. There's no obvious sign of injury, but I will once I can examine the body. Dalton is close enough to reach Val's leg. Then he looks about, assessing. If you're considering whether you should drop, I say, the answer is yes. He lowers himself. A quick gasp as the icy glacial runoff soaks him. He's on his knees, stable now and less than a foot from Val. Dalton reaches for her trouser leg. Her corpse rocks, as if even his body mass disrupts the rush of water. He lets out a curse and grabs for her, but that movement unsnagged her blouse and her body shoots off downstream. I take a running leap along the rocky path, but Dalton shouts, "No!" And he's right. The water is moving fast, and Val's body is hurtling faster than I can run along this uneven shore.
"She'll come to rest farther down," he says. "It lets out into a small lake. We'll get her there."
We're up on the cliffside with Cipher and Storm. Dalton has explained that he saw my yellow flag and they'd been by it when Storm started howling. Which means I suspect she really had initially scented Dalton and only diverted when she smelled Val, the target I'd set her on. Doing as she'd been told, while her master freaked out, mistaking her for a feckless puppy. When we reach them, Cipher has something for me. The young cougar. "You went back for that?" I say.
"Fuck no. I was busy watching you two fools in case you needed grown-up help. We found him,"
he hefts the carcass,
"up by your flag. When your pup started yowling, I grabbed the cat and..."
He swings the cougar over his shoulders to demonstrate. "And ran down the mountain with a 100-pound cougar on your back?"
"Wasn't gonna leave him for scavengers. Had some fine shooting. I'm guessing by the placement of those bullet holes, the cat was mid-leap when you put them in him."
I nod. "They didn't kill him, though."
"Disabled him. That's all that matters. And you knew what to do next. Put the kitty out of his misery. See, now that's what I need."
"Someone to put you down?"
Dalton says. Cipher rolls his eyes.
"I mean a girl like Casey to keep me company. Smart and pretty. A good conversationalist, knows how to take care of herself. If I found one who could cook and clean too, I'd be set."
He looks at me.
"What do you figure my odds are?"
"Excellent," I say. "If you're 25, gorgeous, have a PhD, and can bench press triple your body weight."
"Two out of four ain't bad."
"Never knew you had a PhD,"
Dalton says.
"And the boy makes a proper comeback. The next step? Make one that's actually funny."
Chapter 34. Shortly after that, Cipher leaves us. He'll drop off the cougar at his camp, where he insists on preparing the skin for me. We continue on to retrieve Val's body, but we can't find it. She's out of sight by the time we reach the top of the cliffside, and we follow the stream along until we reach the lake where Dalton is certain her body will stop. We don't see her there. At some point, her clothing must have caught again and submerged her body. I'm not sure what we'll do about this. I want to find her, obviously, but someone else is missing too. Someone who is almost certainly still alive. Jacob. Dalton tells me his brother's campsite seems to have been abandoned before the black bear found it. It's a hunting camp, a basic tent, sleeping furs, and the backpack we saw the bear rummaging through. The only thing missing? Jacob. That could suggest he was just out hunting, if he hadn't left his gun. And the food bag he'd hoisted into a tree was full. That makes no sense, I say as we walk. If Brady found Jacob at his camp, he'd take the gun and food.
Then he must not have found him at camp. Jacob could have been out scouting.
Without his rifle? Dalton shrugs.
Getting water, then.
And you're sure it was Jacob's sight?
100%. His gun, his pack.
I want to say that I don't think Jacob could be captured so easily, or that Brady would have forced him back to take his supply stash. But yes, Brady could have surprised Jacob, and he might not have realized Jacob would have food nearby.
We'll stop at Rockton,
he says.
Get Will and a couple of others and head out to look for Val.
Which seems to be the right move, but it's not. This winter, when we had a fatality in town, Anders had said,
I can't fix dead.
It wasn't just a jibe, though. It was hard truth. We can't fix dead. Val is dead. Brady killed her. We know those two things. So autopsying her body will only tell us how he did it. Brady won't ever see the inside of a courtroom, though, especially for anything he does up here. I do want to put Val's body to rest, but how much of that is about me and not her? She's gone, and I blame myself, and I want to do something for her, and the only thing I can do is retrieve her remains. Would she care? No. The only thing she'd care about is justice. If we think Brady might have taken Jacob, that's all the more reason to focus on him. We retrieve the ATV and return to Rockton. With everything that has happened, it feels as if it should be nightfall by now. Instead, it's 2 PM, and we're still able to grab a late counter-service lunch. Dalton takes Anders, Jen, and another militia member and heads back on the ATVs to search for Val. I stay behind. One of us should, and Dalton wants me to tend to my various scrapes and bruises and pulled muscles. When I don't argue, he gives me a look as if to ask what I'm up to. But I tell him I don't want to slow them down, and someone does need to be here in case Brady circles back. Plus, I have to tend to the wolf cub, change his dressings, and look for signs of rabies. I think it's the last excuse that convinces him. I'm still worried about Dalton's bite, so that makes sense. I put Storm in the house. I hate locking her in, but the alternative is a recap of pup versus cub. When I open the door to my old house, I hear the scrabble of claws as the cub races behind my couch. This time, I can lure him out with meat scraps. I haven't proven dangerous so far, and that monster isn't howling and scratching at the door. I replace his dressings and check for signs of rabies. I see none, and by this point I'm starting to agree he isn't infected. As I change his dressing, I resist the urge to scratch behind his ears or cuddle him. That is oddly difficult, more than it would be with a human patient. We're already crossing a line by feeding him, associating humans with food. Yet we aren't sure what else to do, besides declare him rabies-free and dump him into the forest to fend for himself. Abandon him to die. That's what we'd be doing. And neither of us suggests that. When the door opens, I grab for the cub. I'm accustomed to Storm as a puppy, where an open door meant freedom. Instead, the wolf cub dives back behind the sofa. Matthias walks in. Before I can give him shit for not knocking, he says in French,
I want the wolf dog.
Yeah, no. He's not a
pet. I realize that. No one else will.
He purses his lips.
Except Dalton. And, of course, you, but you already have Storm. Therefore, giving you guardianship of another animal would be unfair.
No one is taking this cub. The whole not-a-pet issue.
Which is why I'm requesting guardianship.
He crouches to peer at the cub.
Australian Shepherd.
Hmm?
The dog blood is Australian Shepherd. I am familiar with the breed. My family owns several. It's a working dog, like all shepherds. I believe that will help counteract the wolf blood, and the combination of the two will produce an excellent guard dog. Possibly even an acceptable hunting dog, given the wolf instincts.
When I say nothing, he looks over.
What is the alternative? It cannot be returned to the wild at this age. It cannot be released once it is grown. It cannot be given to anyone in town who will, despite all protestations, expect a dog like Storm. I have scraps to feed it, I have the time to train it. I am bored. It will be a project for me.
I'm not sure an animal should be a cure for boredom, Matthias.
Then consider it a favor. To you. Otherwise, you will be placed in an impossible situation. You'll never euthanize an animal you have rescued and cared for. So you will be forced to add it to your household, which introduces a dilemma. It cannot sleep by your bed like Storm, or roam freely as she does. Yet if Storm bonds with the cub as a packmate, you must treat them the same, which means either restricting her or being dangerously lax with him.
I hunker back on my haunches. Did you hear about Val?
All right. You are not outright refusing me, which means you are changing the subject so you may consider my request. Also, you are reminding me that this might not be the time to make such a request. Yes, I heard she is dead. I also know you will feel responsible. If you wish to discuss that, I would remind you that Isabel is the therapist.
I'm not looking for therapy or absolution. You were there. You know what happened. I chose to let Brady take Val because that seemed the best chance for her survival.
True.
I carry the wolf cub's bowl into the kitchen for fresh water. The question I want to ask you is why? Why would Brady kill her? Yes, we suspect he's a serial killer, but his M.O. suggests he likes torture in captivity. Would a quick kill serve the same purpose?
No,
he says as I return with the water.
But the urge to kill is... People often use the analogy of hunger or thirst. I prefer sex. Most of us enjoy it, and it satisfies a need, yet we can survive without it. For a murderer who likes to torture his victims, a quick death is akin to shower masturbation with someone banging on the door telling you to hurry up. It won't scratch the itch, but it does the job in a pinch.
I set the bowl down along with more meat scraps. When the cub comes out from behind the couch, Matthias crouches and takes a piece, holding it out. I make a noise in my throat, and he says,
"That is an excellent Mama Wolf impression, Casey."
You know what I mean.
Oh, but I do. The same thing Mama Wolf would. Watch myself, because you have not yet decided whether I pose a threat to your little one.
He feeds the cub.
Are we certain Brady murdered Val?
He murdered Brent.
Which is not the same thing. And yet it is to you, isn't it? If he murdered your friend Brent, then you are not wasting time wondering if he is also responsible for Val. You will determine that when you have the body, but for now it does not matter.
Should it?
I suppose not.
I want to snap. Then why bring it up?
I don't.
He's only nudging doubts I don't want nudged. Brent is dead. There is no question that Brady shot him. But the question of intent is murkier. The gun went off during a fight. I want to say that doesn't matter. Death as a result of an armed robbery is still homicide. Brady also failed to do anything to help Brent after he'd been shot. He ground his fist into the injury. Therefore, he must be the monster his stepfather claims he is. Yet I keep hearing him in the clinic, telling me not to test him, not to underestimate his desperation. Desperate enough to take a hostage. Desperate enough to threaten to kill me. Desperate enough to waylay Brent in hopes of finding Jacob. And Val? When I realized she'd been in the water for a while, I jumped to the conclusion that this proved Brady killed her. Of course it doesn't. In fact, if I'm being brutally honest, the location of her corpse suggests he might not be the culprit. While it's possible that Brady led her up the mountainside and then killed her, I don't see the point of that. My theory was that her body had been dragged upstream by a large predator. Yet, is it not equally likely that Val herself fled in the wrong direction? That she escaped Brady, or he let her go, and she ran toward the nearest landmark? Climbed the mountain, hoping for a good vantage point, and then slipped into the gorge? I don't want to think that. I need the simple answer for now. That Brady murdered her, and therefore, if I see him, I am free to shoot. He killed Brent, he killed Val, he is a killer. The end. Chapter 35. Dalton returns at dinner hour. They didn't find Val. The stream is too narrow and shallow to miss her body, but there are several pools along the way. We have no equipment for diving, and the glacial water is still too cold for sustained searching. So they return, tired, frustrated, and empty-handed. Dalton finds me in our house. I'm taking a shower with Storm, kind of, having trained her to lie with her head inside the partially open door so she can enjoy the spray without actually getting in with me. Afterward, I'm dressing while packing a bag. He's too preoccupied to notice the latter.
"I've decided you're right,"
he says as he lounges on the bed, watching me scurry about in my bra and panties. "Am I?"
"About Jacob, that is. There are other reasons he might abandon camp temporarily. Bears, for one, and I didn't see his bow. He might have been out with that, got let off by good hunting."
"Uh-huh." I tuck one of his shirts into the bag.
"Even if Brady did get the jump on him, that doesn't mean he kept him. Jacob isn't some kid wandering the forest. He knows how to take care of himself."
"He does." I grab toothbrushes and paste from the bathroom. Then I start pulling on my jeans and shirt.
"But if it wasn't easy or safe to escape, Jacob would do the smart thing and give Brady what he wants. Lead him in the general direction of the nearest community. It'd take a fucking week to walk there, but that's a week for Jacob to escape."
"True." I heft the bag. "Needs marshmallows."
"Marshmallows?"
"For the bonfire," I say as I head downstairs. I'm on the first level by the time he calls down.
"What bonfire?"
"The one we'll have when we stop to camp. We should get going, though, while we still have light. You grab the marshmallows and bring Storm. I'll meet you at the stables." Dalton doesn't argue with my plan, which is that we're going hunting for Jacob immediately. All the self-talk in the world won't keep us from worrying. At least searching eases the tension, making us feel as if we are accomplishing something productive. First, we check the marked tree and find the flag to tell Jacob we want to talk. Next, we travel to a spot he sometimes uses for a temporary camp. There's no sign he's been there. He has a more permanent site where he hides his gear, but Dalton has no idea where it is. He grumbles about that tonight, like he always does. Usually, that's just hurt feelings, and I tease that it's like when the brothers were little and Dalton had hiding spots to escape Jacob. Now Dalton knows what that feels like. It's a good analogy, too. Jacob avoids questions about his main camp because he doesn't particularly want his brother there. Part of it might be privacy, but I think more is fear of being judged. Dalton is physically incapable of keeping his opinions to himself, particularly when those opinions relate to how others are living their lives. We occasionally need that blunt honesty and hard push toward what we secretly know is the right path. But there's a limit to how much honesty and pushing anyone wants. And Dalton struggles to find that line. I think Jacob imagines his brother seeing his permanent camp and finding all the faults with it, all the reasons he should make Rockton his base camp. Better to just firmly draw that line for Dalton.
"I love you, brother, but this is my space, and thou shalt not pass."
Now, though, not knowing where to find that permanent camp gives Dalton a real reason to complain. We return to the abandoned camp to search it better. We confirm that, yes, Jacob's bow is missing. While he has the rifle, that's mostly for protection. It's the bow he keeps strung across his back in case he spots dinner. We set Storm to work here. I pull a sweater from inside the tent and let her sniff, and she does a little dance of joy. On the long list of people she adores, Jacob is near the top, and she's been racing about camp already, sniffing and looking for him. Now realizing that he is her target makes her far happier than when we gave her Val and Brady. The moment I let her sniff Jacob's sweater, she's off like a flash. Fortunately, I learned my lesson with the cougar. She's on a lead now, and Dalton is holding it. She can't take him butt surfing, no matter how hard she pulls. She snuffles around the campsite for about 3 seconds and then zooms into the forest. She doesn't go far. Apparently, she's found the path Jacob uses for his latrine, which means it's well-traveled and goes nowhere useful. When she comes back, she takes it slower, unraveling scent trails. She follows the one we came in on and then pauses, as if considering. We've been working on teaching her to age scents, parse older ones from new. She circumvents the camp again. Then she takes off on a trail leading into the forest. She commits to this one, which makes things tricky when it goes through trees too dense for the horses. I go back for them, climb onto Cricket, and take Blaze's reins. Dalton's gelding isn't thrilled with that plan, but he follows and we circle around while whistles from Dalton keep us going in the right direction. We spend an hour like that. I ride and lead Blaze while trying not to stray too far from Dalton's signals. Twice, Jacob's path joins a trail, which makes it easier, until he cuts through the bush again. Dalton finds no sign of trouble, no indication of an ambush or a fight. But eventually we hit a rocky patch, and Storm loses the scent. She tries valiantly to find it again, grumbling her frustration when she can't. We have some idea of the general direction Jacob was headed, though, so we continue that way, both on horseback now, while Storm runs alongside, her nose regularly lifting to test the air.
"Satellite phones," Dalton says after a while.
"I know." I'd been advocating sat phones. I remember when I first moved here, I thought that's what Val used. When it turned out to be some kind of high-tech, dedicated radio receiver, I presumed that was because nothing else would work. But Dalton and I did some research when we were down south, and we discovered there was no reason sat phones shouldn't work. We just don't have them, because they'd allow us to call out, which is against Rockton rules. Also, even calls between phones in such an isolated region could trigger unwanted interest. We have discussed getting them anyway, for emergencies, and now is the perfect example of when a satellite phone could be a lifesaver. "We'd need to know whether they could be detected," I say, "and figure out how to get an account without a credit card and ID. They aren't like cell phones. You can't grab a prepaid."
"Yeah.
It might be possible to buy one on the black market." "Yes, I'm talking about that as if I have a clue how to get anything on the black market. But I might be able to figure out..." I trail off as Storm stops. She's sniffing the air. Then the fur on her back rises and she reverses toward me, which means toward Cricket, making my horse do a little two-step before snorting and nose-smacking the dog. I pull Cricket to a halt and swing my leg over, but Dalton says,
"Hold,"
and I wait. Storm growls. I resist the urge to comfort her. If she senses trouble, I want her warning us. Storm is sitting right against Cricket's foreleg. The mare exhales as if in exasperation and nudges the dog, but there's no nip behind it. And when Cricket lifts her head, she catches a scent too.
"Step out!"
Dalton's voice startles me. The animals, too. Storm glancing back sharply. Cricket two-stepping again. Only Blaze stays where he is, rock steady as always.
"We're armed,"
Dalton says as he takes out his gun.
"I know you're there, just to the left of the path. Come out, or we'll set the dog on you."
Chapter 36. Silence answers. I haven't heard whatever Dalton and the animals must. Then he says,
"Storm, get ready."
And there's a rustle in the undergrowth ahead. A boy steps onto the path. He can't be more than 12. I see him, and the first thing I think of is Dalton. That this boy is already older than he would have been when the former sheriff took him from the forest. The boy looks so young. It's easy to think of 12 as the cusp of adolescence, but it is still childhood, even out here. And that's what I see. A boy with a knife clenched in one hand, struggling to look defiant as he breathes fast. Dalton looks at the boy and his jaw hardens. Then he aims his glower into the forest.
That's a fucking coward's move, and you ought to be ashamed of yourselves, pushing a kid out here. Did I mention we have guns? And a dog?
The boy's gaze goes to Storm. He tilts his head, and I have to smile, remembering how Jacob mistook her for a bear cub. Storm, I say, stand. She does, and her tail wags. The boy isn't the threat she smelled, proving Dalton is right about there being others.
If you're planning an ambush,
he calls,
you do realize that the person I'm going to shoot at is the one I see, which happens to be a child.
I'm not a child, the boy says, straightening. He pushes back his hood, and I realize he's not a boy either. It's a girl, maybe 14. And I'm alone, she says. I came hunting and—
Yeah, yeah. There are three other people over there who obviously think my night vision sucks.
Sucks what? The girl says. I chuckle at that, and she looks over at me. You're a girl, she says.
Woman, Dalton says, and a police detective, armed with a gun. Now sit your ass down.
You can't tell me.
I just did.
He points the gun. The girl sits so fast she almost falls. I say, Storm, guard, which is a meaningless command, but I pair it with a hand gesture that means she can approach the girl to say hello. The girl shrinks back as the big canine draws near. Storm sits in front of her and waits to be petted. Patiently waits, knowing this is clearly coming.
Three people, Dalton calls. I want to see you all on this path by the count of 10. Your girl seems a little nervous, and if she runs, I can't be held responsible for what our dog will do.
Storm plunks down with a sigh, her muzzle resting beside the girl's homemade boot, as if resigned to wait for her petting. Just don't move, I say to the girl. You'll be fine. Dalton begins his countdown. By the time he finishes, a man and a woman have emerged from the trees. Both are on the far side of 50.
It's only us, the woman says. You have miscounted.
Then you have mistaken me for an idiot incapable of counting, he raises his voice. I see you coming around beside me. Do you see the gun pointed at your fucking head?
Silence. Then a dark figure appears from the shadows, heading for Blaze.
Yeah, no,
Dalton says.
If you're planning to spook my horse, thinking he'll unseat me?
Dalton lowers the gun a foot over Blaze's head and fires. Cricket does her two-step and whinnies, but Blaze only twitches his ear as if a fly buzzed past.
Now get up there with the others, Dalton says.
A young man steps out. He has a brace of rabbits over his shoulder.
Good hunting,
I say. He only stares. Keep staring, his gaze traveling over me a little too slowly.
Answer her and keep your fucking eyes on her face, Dalton says. She asked you a polite question as a reminder of how civilized people behave when they come across one another, each outminding their own business in the forest.
You his girl?
The young man asks.
She's...
Dalton hesitates, and I know he wants to say, my detective, because that is the respectful way to introduce me. But it might imply I'm single, and from the looks this kid is giving me, we'd best not go there. I'm his wife, I say, and Dalton's gaze cuts my way, but he only grunts and says,
Yeah, my wife and my detective.
What's a detect?
The girl begins, but the older woman cuts her off with a look. I was a police officer down south, I say. Law enforcement.
Down there and up here, Dalton says.
Here being Rockton,
the older man says.
I know you. You're Steve's boy, Jacob's brother.
And you're from the first settlement.
The man nods.
We're looking for Jacob, Dalton says. You seen him?
The older man and woman nod. The younger man's gaze alternates between me and Blaze, the look in his eyes suggesting we are of equal value, both chattels he covets. When he glances at Dalton, I see the dissatisfaction of a child looking on an older one, wondering what he's done to deserve all the good toys. The girl is busy staring at Storm, and while Dalton talks to the woman, an older man, I murmur, "Storm, up." The dog rises and the girl falls back. No one else notices, and I tell her not